Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Morin.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
This is What's Next, a dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race, equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next. Today, our guest, Chaney Brockington. Chaney is a licensed master social worker and also works at ECMC and the BRAVE program as well. We're going to get into that. Chaney, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jay, and to the entire cast and crew here. Well, we really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's interesting because, we look at some of the things you want to talk about, generational patterns and trauma within Buffalo, Buffalo's history of mass incarceration, Black mental health. These are topics that we have frequently touched upon here on this program. So we're most certainly welcoming your input and your perspectives as well. Let's maybe just a little background, though. You're a relatively young individual. How did you veer toward this field?
That's a great question. Yeah. So I'm originally not from here, from the Hudson Valley, Catskill Mountain region. Shout out to all my family that is there and might be listening later on, but grew up there in that area and went to school at Le Moyne College in Syracuse and studied psychology. At the time, I was getting a dual degree program. Mm. So I was studying, getting the bachelor's in psychology, and then I was also doing the dual education program there, and I was planning to be a teacher.
Okay.
And found out very later on in the student teaching development that teaching was not going to be the right field for me. I was doing my first year, foundation year, student teaching in Syracuse City School District with some amazing students, some amazing first and second graders who at the time were struggling with just systemic barriers to having the educational classroom and the educational experience that they truly deserved. Not having access to food, not having access to water, having housing instability, just poverty, right? Systemic and generational poverty.
Right.
And unfortunately, that was really affecting the way that we were interacting in the classroom. They weren't able to focus.
Mm-hmm.
We were oftentimes struggling for snack breaks. Kids were coming with really significant mental health concerns as well at such a young age. And so being a teacher was important, meeting the academic standards for testing that we do have in New York State was important, but I was really struggling to get through it, to be honest with you. It was just very, very difficult. I would stop oftentimes throughout the day just to make sure that they had something to eat, and we just weren't getting through lessons. And I had an amazing advisor, an amazing supervisor at the time that would sit and we would talk after, and I'd say, I can't get through these lessons.
Mm.
My kids need other things, right? They don't have clothes, or they're worried about what's going to happen when they get home, and we have to address those things because it's very difficult for them to have that concentration that we're looking for. And we had kept talking about it, kept brainstorming, and essentially what we acknowledged was this is one of the systemic barriers of our education system.
Right.
We expect our students to all perform at a certain level, but they all don't have all of the basic needs that they need to in order to perform at that level.
So this changed your professional direction.
But 100%.
I wouldn't mind just staying at that moment for just a little bit.
Sure.
Because what you just said, the systemic realities that these young kids, little kids, were facing, you saw them. And now you can see them, looking back, as somebody who's now, a licensed mental health professional, someone who's dealing with it. Maybe even give us a specific story or stories that you recall of, like you said, we were in a situation, I'm student teaching, I'm trying to get these kids through this lesson, and so-and-so kid shows this because of that. Can you maybe reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, a couple actually came to mind. I remember we were teaching a math lesson, you know, first, second grade. Students aren't broken up into different classes. It's all at the same time and all in the same classroom. And I was actually teaching a math lesson. And of course, with passing the EdTPA or the assessment for teaching in general, you have to follow these different core components of these classrooms. And so we were teaching a math lesson, and two of my students actually, and I believe that they were half brother and half sister, and they both came up in the middle of the math lesson and said, you know, my stomach really hurts. And so I was like, okay, let's, you know, take you to the nurse's station. Let's make sure that you get cleared up. Of course, the nurse brings them back and says, oh, well, you know, they're fine. They probably just don't want to be in math class, whatever the case may be, you know, which, you know, could be a legitimate thing for young kids.
Well, certainly it was always my excuse.
Exactly. Sometimes I didn't want to be in math, right? So I'm like, okay. So they bring them back into the classroom. And I believe it was at the end of the math lesson, I'm sitting down with them, and I trying to show them, you know, here's what it is to do, give them some extra special attention, which is difficult in a room of 21 students. And I was, you know, trying to give them some specialized instruction, and I could hear their stomachs start to growl.
Oh.
And I was like, is that your tummy? And they were like, yeah, it really, really hurts. So they were hungry. And so we identified, when was the last time that you've eaten today? Really started to identify, when was the last time that you actually had a meal? And it was the day before.
Oh my.
So I believe their last meal was probably leaving the school at the end of the day, having that lunch or that snack at the end of the day that we oftentimes provided in our classroom.
Right.
And so I identified, okay, we got to get some snacks. We need to, you know, address this issue. But they were so distracted and so focused that by the time we got to the whole snack portion, that's it, right? You only have a certain amount of time to get through everything that you need to every day as a teacher. And I know that that example may sound somewhat minimal to someone that's listening, but this is happening on a consistent basis, right? These are two students. We had students every day that were coming in with a different barrier or a different challenge. Oftentimes, students would come in and they would be in tears because of some intimate partner violence that they saw, or CPS being called, or having a parent that in some way was not able to care for them in the way that they deserved. And so having those consistent barriers and watching how it is that students systemically aren't able to accomplish what is needed in their system was just a very riveting thing. And having the privilege of coming from a background of going to predominantly, you know, seminary schools, Catholic preparatory schools, and not seeing those disparities in our educational system until actually moving into college, it was very, very jarring to me. And it made me realize very quickly on that if this is the way that I'm going to have to teach my students, and shout out to all the teachers that do this incredible work on a daily basis, but if this is the way that I'm going to have to teach my students, I don't think I'll be able to continue in this path. I want to make sure that I'm getting to their root causes, their basic needs, so they can have that opportunity to perform in the best way possible.
So you made the switch.
You made the career switch.
So you go from Syracuse, you come to the University of Buffalo to advance your studies,
yes,
of course. But now you get to see Buffalo.
Yeah.
Now, how does the city classrooms in Syracuse, as best you understand, compare to what we see in Buffalo?
Yeah, that was, it's very shocking. I think that one of the things that I did, and this is going a little bit off topic.
That's fine.
But I was an adjunct faculty over at UB, came back to my alma mater, and taught there for two semesters, actually. And we taught the Black Lives Matter class, Building Racial Justice and Solidarity. And one of the activities that I had my students do was an activity was called City of Good Neighbors. And the reason why is because obviously that is a very big slogan and umbrella for Buffalo, is this idea of City of Good Neighbors, and the kind of the cornerstone of like a Buffalo slogan, if you will.
It's definitely a slogan.
It's definitely a slogan for sure, right? And so one of the things that we had them do in this activity that we would do every week was to address a different experience or a different news article or some research on Buffalo as a whole. and some of the disparities that we're seeing as it relates to race. Because the idea is that if it's a city of good neighbors, it should be a city of good neighbors for everybody, right? Everybody should have equal opportunity. Everybody should be feeling as if they are receiving, you know, good neighborship, if you will.
Sure.
And so what my students very quickly found is that it has not been. And that is the same exact thing that I found as it relates to going into our school districts, our school systems, but also just our criminal justice system, right? Our current layout of land, our history of segregation. And being someone who is a non-Buffalo native, I know it can be very jarring to hear someone that's not from the area say, oh, well, I'm going to do all of this research. But I think it's important. I think it's important when you go into a new city and you move in to know the lay of the land, to know the history, to know how it is that it's affected the people and the residents that call Buffalo home. And so we found similar disparities, but unfortunately more in our school systems. Our school system here in Buffalo is on track to be very, very close to what we're seeing in New York City. We have out-of-school suspension rates that are very similar to New York City and to other larger cities, and we don't nearly have the concentration per capita. But yet those statistics are very similar, if not higher, here in Buffalo. We also have 4 out of 5 students in Buffalo qualifying for free or reduced lunch at this time. And that study was it was post 2020,
okay.
But still a couple of years ago.
Right.
And so the number is growing exponentially. It's projected to be at about 4.5 out of Buffalo City residents and students being qualifying for free or reduced lunch.
So if 4 out of 5 students are qualifying for free lunches at school or reduced lunches at school, it's safe to assume that there are, of those, there are several who are struggling with food on a regular basis. Going back to your earlier story of the 7 and 8 year olds who couldn't stay in class because their stomachs were hurting because they were starving.
Absolutely. A lot of our students, and I've heard this from incredible individuals that do a lot of the food trust here, such as the African Heritage Food Co-op, such as the amazing talks and conversations, such as the Buffalo Black Caucus that's hosted by Zanetta Everhart, and so many other different conversations and community forums and community rallies for change and advocacy, that oftentimes our students, their last meal that they're having is either at the school district or at home, but there is a level of food insecurity that sometimes can still be present at the home. If you have students that are qualifying for free or reduced lunch, it's not anything of their doing, and oftentimes it's not anything of their parents doing. It's systematically related, but at the same time, we know that that means that those students' income for the household is at or below poverty level.
I don't want to necessarily get too general, but if we can see that there are these many students struggling with basic issue like hunger, what's the likelihood that we're going to see those kids fall into that next level, that student suspension level that often we hear about the classroom to prison pipelines or school to prison pipeline? What about that? Can you take us through that a little bit and those associations?
Absolutely. There is a huge intersectionality there. And I just have to quickly also shout out Duncan Kirkwood, who really rallied a huge change. I moved to Buffalo in 2016, met Duncan shortly after in 2017, 2018, and at the time had just finished an amazing run for a city office position, but also had done some incredible rallying around his community, stakeholders, participants, and members of the community involved, which is a very big part of really pushing social justice advocacy to eliminate, essentially, and work to eradicate, at a bare minimum, reduce the Buffalo City school suspension rate.
Right.
And the reason why is, I mean, it's really, I don't want to say simple, but, you know, basic psychology, which is my area of bread
okay.
and butter.
All right.
Right?
So, I got the right person here, right? Yeah.
No, for sure. But it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs, mm-hmm. right? If anyone's ever seen it, it's that big triangle. It's
right.
got those different levels. There are 2 basic needs that every human needs to have in order to meet those additional levels of, you know, self-actualization, of trust, of realization, of learning, of like this higher calling. And those basic levels are safety and security. Safety includes not just, you know, psychology, psychological safety, but also physiological safety. So having your basic needs met, such as housing, food, shelter, clothing, water, all of those basic things. If you're not able to have those basic things, you are then going to really struggle, if not be able to obtain that next level of self-actualization, of being able to understand educational values, to be able to develop your own core values and your own core belief systems, which are going to then allow you to become that next stage, or as we call it in American terms, productive member, quote unquote, of society.
There's all sorts of meaning inside that, but I'll
absolutely right. There's so much meaning.
Right.
And I'm sure we'll touch on that a little bit later. But I say all that to say that when we have students that do not have their basic needs met, and when we have a city where those basic needs have not been met for a while, and there are individuals, trained, educationed individuals in that city that understand the generational patterns, that understand the generational traumas that have happened, and are watching their communities not receive the same resources as other communities, not only are there emotions that come from that, but there are just physiological changes that take place. So when you bring a student and they don't have their basic needs met, the likelihood of them being able to sit in a desk, which for most adults is difficult throughout
Certainly.
The day, right? You
Absolutely.
Know, we talk about going to the water jug. That used to be the pre-COVID joke,
right?
Going to the water jug or going to take a smoke break or a regular break or a non-smoker's break, right? It's very difficult to sit in a seat for 8 hours and continue your job. For a child that's still growing, that is a extremely difficult task to just be done, regardless of whether you're in a traditional or non-traditional classroom setting. So when we then expect students that have not had the proper adequate care, have maybe possibly dealt with possible violence at home, or just not adaptive home life situations, have dealt with housing insecurity, right? Not just food, but just housing insecurity. Haven't had a safe bed to sleep in at night. Maybe haven't had a bed to sleep in at night. Had to sleep on somebody's couch because there's something going on in the household. Economic insecurity. Don't have the proper shoes to wear. Don't have the proper gear to wear because they're going to have to walk because we don't have a busing system in the way that other school districts and other cities do.
Right.
All those basic barriers. The likelihood of them being able to get in the classroom, sit for 8 hours, not cause any what we're calling disruption, and be prepared for class is staggering. And then when you look at what our students are being suspended for, right, it's not what we fantasize and what we unfortunately fearmonger people to believe. It's not, you know, a student is fighting or stabbing, which we have seen, and I'm not denying that.
Sure.
But it's oftentimes they were out of dress code. Right. They responded to a teacher in a way that they didn't feel was appropriate. They used language that is sometimes either used at home or that they've heard friends utilize, or language that just is not traditionally appropriate for a classroom setting. They've talked back to a student. When you're looking at those infractions and what the infractions are for, their hair was not in the appropriate way. And then you're sending them back home into a system where they're already not then going to have their needs met. There's a staggering chance that not only, A, they're going to re-likely be suspended again, because all it takes is one time, and those statistics have been shown.
That's you're saying that there's no doubt about that.
Absolutely, right? There's a, I believe it's...
So it's not if I suspend you for a month, you're going to learn your lesson.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's not if I suspend you for a month, you're going to learn your lesson.
You're
going to
change, you're going to be this
Great student. You're going to come back rehabilitated is the idea. It's... we're going to come back, and more than likely, I'm going to do this again, right? And it's going to continue to happen again. And similar to our justice system, once you are suspended once, you're on somebody's radar, right? It's not just, okay, well, you've done your time, and then we turn, and that's the issue with our criminal justice system as a whole, right? It's not we've done your time, and now we are going to wipe the slate clean, be transformative about making sure that you have opportunities so that the same decisions or the same circumstances that were arraigned previously are not going to be there in the past. You kind of have a target on your back a little bit, right? There is a radar that's there. There is a presence that's there, and there is an implicit bias that goes into a teacher looking and seeing a name now that they have now suspended or that has been involved in the start or the root of the justice system before and then reentering that again. But the likelihood of then having some type of criminal legal interaction, police interaction, school police officer, school resource officer interaction then increases. And once that happens, you just have that perfect trajectory into the school to prison pipeline. The data has shown that it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Really?
And that's the really scary part about it, for sure, and troubling part
and
about
almost
it.
Inevitable.
Almost inevitable. I believe the statistics were, it's 1 in 3 as the justice system relates over the age of 18. It's 1 or 3 males of color will have an interaction with the justice system before the age of 50 years old. We know that that oftentimes starts at an earlier age, average between the ages of 18 and 23. But when we look at the statistics and we include out-of-school suspension rates, that number jumps. I believe that it is somewhere around like 64% of individuals that have had an out-of-school suspension are likely to have another suspension. But especially when we look at Black and brown youth, we see that there's 84% of all of the youth that are suspended in our public school system are African American. And so even those numbers speak to a larger issue there.
Our guest this morning on What's Next is Chaney Brockington. Chaney is a licensed master's social worker, but as you can hear from our conversation, she brings a level of expertise to a number of issues. Again, things that we have talked about at different times here, but it's always good to get the fresh perspective and a fresh voice on many of these issues. You are a member of the board member of the Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition.
Yes.
Restorative justice.
Mm-hmm.
To you, what is restorative justice?
Yeah. Oh, restorative justice. That is a tough word. And if you ask 15 different people,
sure,
I promise you'll get 35 different answers.
Okay.
I've talked about this a couple of times. And restorative justice to me is really this idea of not just repairing harm, but it's also transforming the way in which we look at harm. When we look at offense as a whole in this country, but even on a smaller scale here in Erie County, we are very quick to not just penalize, but also prosecute the individual that has caused the harm and not look at why it is that the harm was caused and how it is that we can properly do justice for the individual that was harmed. Restorative justice looks to kind of transform that model.
Okay.
And in some ways, it's been looked at as a very radical model, but it actually has very, I guess I could say radical results, right? We've seen that the effects of restorative justice being practiced in schools and outside of schools with young adults has been life-changing. Restorative justice really looks to identify what was the harm that was caused to someone at any given time or to a system or to a population of individuals. How did that harm impact that person? What were some of the factors that may have influenced the harm happening in the first place? And kind of a what's next question,
okay, right?
Where do we go from here?
Sure.
How is it that we can make sure that both parties are able to understand why it is that the harm happened and what it is to make sure or what it is that we can do to make sure that that harm does not happen again, that the population and that the community served becomes better as a result of that, and that the community and the population served feel safer as a result.
Okay.
So again, it is also, and what I find and what I love about the work that's done at ECRJ, mm-hmm, is that it's also proactive, not reactive. And I know I use that terminology a lot, but it is also looking at, are there ways that we can get involved before there is harm?
Okay.
Because we know that there will be harm, right?
Right.
We are living in very, very heightened times. It's
no
like
doubt.
The nicest way that I can say
sure.
it, right? We know that unfortunately there will be harm, right? There will be, you know, an incident at a school or something that happens in a neighborhood. We're aware of that, right? Our system tells us that. The lay of the land tells us that. Our map of Buffalo's history, unfortunately, tells us that as well. So it's looking at a proactive approach. How is it that we can get involved before there is harm to make sure that there are systems in place that provide space for others to understand the impact of their harm and in the impacts of harms on their community.
What might be an example of like you said, a proactive approach to that?
Well, I think just even the work that the Restorative Justice Coalition is doing, and that all goes to Dina Thompson and her amazing team and staff over at the Restorative Justice Coalition, getting involved in different school districts. They are involved in many school districts already in the Western New York area and have been doing incredible work to make sure that they are located in the school, that they are doing forums in the school so that the schools are aware of who it is that they can call before something happens.
Right.
Right. If they have the education beforehand, the likelihood of being able to pick up the phone and saying, hey, I have this resource increases.
Okay.
Let's say a student, let's go with taking, which I know has happened, right? Take somebody's phone.
Okay.
Right? They steal a phone in the school district, right? The school's response is immediately, right, to get involved, call school truancy officer, school resource officer, get them involved, suspend the student. Student's out of school for a month or is indefinitely suspended. Now they have to go to another school, reintegrate. The likelihood of them doing just as well at that school or better at that school than they were at the other school, we know, is not even on an equal margin scale. And then the system just starts and it just jets up. In the restorative justice model, right, it's not saying, well, that student doesn't have any penalty. The Restorative Justice Coalition would come together and kind of create a group setting where all the stakeholders are involved. So you might have the teacher that was there the day that the phone was stolen or in the classroom where the phone was stolen. You'd have the student who stole the phone, you'd have the child that's whose phone was stolen, you would have maybe their parents, maybe a pastor or a spiritual leader that is related to or, you know, in close proximity to the student who had their phone stolen from them. And you'd have all these individuals kind of sitting together in a round table to be able to identify what happened here, what exactly took place. Here's the evidence that we have. How is it that the individual who has been harmed is feeling, right? Or as most people would consider the victim,
right?
How is it that the victim or the person that's been harmed is feeling, and give them space to be able to share how it is that this affected them. Well, my mom bought me this phone. You know, I just got this phone for my birthday. It was really expensive. I felt violated, whatever the case may be. When you have a traditional setting where a student is harmed or a person is harmed in some way, oftentimes there isn't that space. There isn't that space for the person who's harmed to say, this is exactly what it is that you did. I want to know this, 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 and this. I want to know why. Even in our court system, when we do have victims that are making an impact statement, they're not getting, it's not a call and response.
Right.
They're usually sitting with the defense and, you know, reading their statement directly to the court system, which, yes, of course, that gives an outlet. It gives space. We deserve to be able to have every voice amplified and every voice heard. And at the same time, there is no call and response usually in those settings.
Right.
In this setting, we're allowing the student to actually have to look the other student in the eye and hear, this is what you did. This is how you harmed me. This is what's happened. This is what's been going on in my family. We also might have the person who has created the offense in the other side with their parents acknowledging, this is how we did the harm. This is why this happened. These are some of the behaviors that were leading up to it. This is what my day was like beforehand. Again, not excusing the behavior, but also giving a setting so that both parties also have a better understanding to learn each other, to reduce the possibility of there being animosity or tension, a fight breaking out later on, because now there's this unsettled harm that's happened and no one's talking about it and these students are just separated. And how it is that we're going to be able to move forward. There may still be a penalty and there's going to be a conversation about it. What is it that needs to happen? Do you know, what is it that the student that has received the harm wants? Do they want an apology? Do they want a letter that's written? Do they want the parents to pay restitution? Oftentimes, restorative justice is working in coercion or in conjunction with different legal services, right? So Office of Probation or School Resource Officer. So it's not, again, completely relinquishing responsibility. If anything, it's amplifying it.
Right.
Because it's forcing you to kind of be in that presence and be here and have an option of saying, here's how I'm going to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And here's how it impacted the community at large.
What are, I mean, and some of them, I guess they pop up as we're talking, but what stands in the way of that type of model? What are the, I'm sure, I see you grimacing as I say that, and I know there's a lot there, and you probably in some ways you want to be kind of delicate the way when you're pointing, but at the same time, there obviously are, right? And we know that there are possibilities to do better for our kids.
Yeah.
What stands in the way? What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's and I did grimace for a moment. It is a grin and a smile. I wear my emotions on my face. one of the things that is major, and this is not just as it relates to our school systems and restorative justice, this is related to our food deserts, this is related to the segregation in Buffalo, this is related to the regeneration or renaissance being all access renaissance for Buffalo, mm-hmm. how it is that we repair our East and West Side, is that we have to have individuals that are willing to steer away from draconian values and to understand our city, our community, our population, and be willing to do the radical work that it's going to require in order to see those changes take place. So for restorative justice baseline, we need to have school systems and school districts and school officials and school superintendents or, you know, cities, public city school superintendents that are open and not just open and saying, okay, well, we can try it and pilot in a couple of different schools. Completely open and receptive to this idea of restorative and transformative change in the school district. We need individuals in our school districts, and that includes all stakeholders, so teachers, again, superintendents, city school officials, right. individuals that have the opportunity to sway common council, individuals that have the opportunity to be able to sway what's taking place in our school systems, to be able to fully be on board and dedicated to seeing that social change. I say this often, I'm not from Buffalo. I'm not a Buffalo native. I am also not directly involved or linked into the city school district, specifically Buffalo City Schools. If I can find the research out there, others can find the research. And others have found the research. There has been a huge push to do a lot of the work that we are talking about, to change the models of the way that the schools operate, especially our public school systems, to change the way in which we are suspending our students, to look at the way in which we are implementing harm reduction models or restorative change in our school districts. But you have to have school and city officials that are open to that change. And that is what we are unfortunately seeing time and time again, is we need to have officials that are willing to see the impact for what it is. And also not blame our students. There is a significant amount of blame, and I have heard it when we were looking to eliminate school suspensions surrounding, well, this is just how our kids behave, and they're bad kids, and this is how they react, and when they react this way, we need to. And that language is extremely jarring. I have not heard that language in a while, thank goodness, and I'm very grateful for that.
Yes.
But I am thinking back specifically to a couple of meetings that I sat in, and hearing that language was extremely concerning and disheartening. Because when we have a perspective that our students are just wanting to be this way, or that our city wants to behave this way, or when certain areas, certain populations, certain demographics, certain races or ethnicities just want this consistent, perpetual system of harm and violence and segregation and, separation mm-hmm. from having opportunity and access to proper resources, it's a really unfortunate and very unhealthy form of victim blaming, and it's not adaptive for seeing what we want to see. It's not adaptive for having a city where jobs are booming and where individuals are all, we can say that we have a high vocational rate of employment. It's not ideal for having a city where we're seeing a renaissance of wealth, not just in the downtown area, but in all the different sides of Buffalo, on the east side and of the west side and Amherst and other areas, right? It's not conducive to that. So there has to be that understanding. There has to be that dedication to research, and not, again, turning that blind eye to research and then saying, well, we'll worry about it in 2030. Mm. And there has to be that willingness to implement that change and give a radical yes.
Stay with us. There's more to come. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Explore the Underground Railroad's final stop. Learn about how the Latine workforce organized to overcome discrimination and follow the timeline of immigration in Western New York.
So remember, history surrounds you and includes you.
Watch Compact History on the Buffalo-Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Chaney Brockington is our guest this morning on What's Next, licensed master's social worker, also a board member of the Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition. Chaney is in private practice as a mental health counselor, but also does work at ECMC in the Brave program. We've jumped around at a couple different things here, so I don't want to miss an opportunity to access your expertise and your experience here. So let's talk about the Brave program at ECMC. Sure.
Absolutely. I am so grateful to the leadership of Dr. Shannon King, Brianna Hill, and Paula Spiro, who have done some incredible work in really curating a program that offers services to our most vulnerable population. Obviously, ECMC is known as, you know, the level one trauma hospital, right? If there is any form of trauma, people know that they are more than likely going to ECMC, and it has that repertoire in the city, and also that, you know, statistics in the city is one of the regions only. Actually, BRAVE is a program that stands for Buffalo Rising Against Violence at ECMC. Mm-hmm. And essentially, it is the region's only hospital-based intervention program for violence. So what BRAVE looks to do is it looks to address individuals who have been victims of both intimate partner violence and or sexual assault, and also predominantly gunshot wound victims, so individuals that have been harmed by gunshot wound. The work is incredible. It is extremely intense because we have a group of social workers, case management, hospital responders who really bridge that gap between coming in to the hospital in one of the worst states of your life and being able to understand exactly what services are available for you and really normalizing those services. We also have therapists like myself and others in our program who are doing incredible work, and then being able, with a referral, being able to work with individuals one-on-one and really create some safety and stabilization. So through therapeutic interventions, but also through, again, bridging that gap and linking them with case management services, assistance with transportation and other resources if needed.
I'm going to put you on the spot here just a little bit. There's always going to be a huge level of confidentiality, of course, when it comes to dealing with any people that are considered to be your patients or clients. At the same time, can you maybe share, like you said, this is, sounds like it's in tremendously intense work. Can you share a story or generalize it to a certain extent of what you see and, you know, how those responses go with people that are in these violent, you know, moments of their lives?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, I want to be mindful of confidentiality. And at the same time, from a broader spectrum, unfortunately, as someone who has been doing this work for a small bit of time and a small drop in the bucket in comparison to some of the amazing individuals that currently work at right. Brave, I do have to say that a lot of the individuals and the clients and patients that we are working with, there is a similarity in some of the unfortunate traumas that they have experienced, okay. right? So based on our program, the referrals that we usually receive are, again, for that intimate partner violence or that gunshot wound. Oftentimes, we are seeing youth that have been devastatingly affected by the harms of just gun violence, especially as we ramp into the summer at Buffalo. It is a known fact that Buffalo has a history of gun violence. It ramps during the summer, but it is prevalent and pervasive, unfortunately, during other months as well. We are right outside of an amazing organization, Bissonnette House, which is run through Peace Prince of Western New York.
Mm, right.
And many people, if they pass by, they've seen the giant dove that's there. And it used to have numbers in it. And those numbers would represent how many days it's been since we haven't had gun violence in the city. It is a tool of hope, right? And it is amazing to see when those numbers are rising. But it is also a tool of grave awareness when you're looking at those numbers that are then dropping back down to zero. And we have seen a large prevalence of that, unfortunately, in our city this year due to the systemic violences. So oftentimes we are seeing young children, we are seeing, you know, older individuals who are have unfortunately been a victim of gun violence. Sometimes it is due to some type of community violence or community harm that's happened, as we were just talking about harm or other circumstances. And oftentimes they are losing their ability to be able to move in the way in which they usually were, becoming a paraplegic, right, in some way, or, you know, losing a part of a body ligament, having brain damage that is affected. But also, it's not always just the physical effects of the violence that can be visually seen. It's also the effects of that type of trauma and that type of stress. So what I'm oftentimes seeing are individuals that have been harmed, not just at the stage of this
what brought them
incident,
to ECMC,
but also a history of complex trauma that's taken place throughout their lives. And now they are, unfortunately, in a space where they have experienced more violence that has oftentimes led to one of the worst days or the worst moments in their life. And so as a result of that, we are seeing complex trauma, as I mentioned before. So kind of trauma on top of trauma, almost stacking like Jenga, if you will. And then coming in and acknowledging that they are experiencing all these different symptoms of what we know PTSD, our post-traumatic stress disorder, right? So hypervigilance, difficulty concentrating, difficulty sleeping at night, nightmares, flashbacks, unable to feel comfortable in the safety of their own home or in the safety of their own community, right? Sometimes struggling with depression and anxiety, so co-recurring symptoms and co-recurring diagnoses. And so that is a large portion of what it is that we see. There's also, again, that intersectionality with what we're seeing from a mental wellness standpoint, what we're seeing as it relates to the physical effects of the violence or the harm that's happened, and then that intersectionality of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So they're coming in, there's a significant amount of trauma, and then there's also a basic need that is not met. There is housing insecurity, there is pervasive homelessness or chronic homelessness that's taking place. There is economic instability, inability to pay hospital bills. So I'm trying to make some significant choices between, do I actually go and get to the hospital or take care of these medical needs that I might have post-operative? Or do I stay home and try to take care of it myself because I literally cannot afford this healthcare system? Food insecurity, all types of different insecurities that we're then seeing that are compounded on top of, you know, can you help me in this short period of time? And we do have a very short, limited period of time, right? Whether that's for counseling or for case management services, because we are serving a very wide population.
Right.
And so essentially you are triaging all the different parts of somebody, the medical need, the trauma, the victimization, the effects of that trauma and what that looks like from a mental wellness standpoint, and then also compounded on top of all of the basic needs that probably weren't met before they came into the door, but that are now at a heightened sense of needing to be addressed as soon as possible. And so essentially, we are jugglers. We are consistently juggling and making sure that not only that these needs are being met, but that our program is run correctly, that we are addressing the needs in a timely fashion, that we are responding in a timely fashion. And so it is definitely a lot, but that the work that is done at Brave is absolutely incredible.
I find sometimes that people say there's lots of services, but the information isn't getting to the right person. It sounds like this program is totally geared toward that in an urgent manner, right? Are you having success in connecting the person, the victim, I'll use that word, with the things that they might need to at least get through this time?
Yeah, absolutely. So there is, I think it's another one of those both ands.
Okay.
Or kind of yes and then unfortunately no.
All right.
Obviously, as a responder, you do your best to try to meet as many needs as possible. Sometimes those needs are greater than just what one person might need, right? I can't we might not be able to solve the entire housing insecurity, but we can also then make sure that they are linked with clinical case management or additional services to assist with that housing stability, link with victim services or Office of Victim Services to make sure that any post-incident needs that need to be met. So whether that's a medical supply or a medical provision, or that is some additional form of resource, that is met in some way, shape, or form.
An interesting note, though, we did talk about this just a little bit. You got involved in doing some speaking at St. Joe's Collegiate Institute here in Buffalo. And it's interesting to see, you know, what the subject matter was, but also the response from the students. Could you share that experience with us?
Yeah, absolutely. And a quick shout out to St. Joe's. That was my first time actually going to St. Joe's.
Okay.
And as somebody who, grew up with, as I mentioned before, the Franciscans and the Jesuits,
right.
I went to a Franciscan college preparatory school, and then I also went to Lemoyne, which is the Jesuit school.
Right.
They do some incredible work, and their schools are fantastic. St. Joe's is an amazing program. From the second that I walked in, I could just tell this is just a unique, very special place. And every person that I spoke with that is an alumni of St. Joe's, the teachers that were there, they all say the same thing. So wonderful program. St. Joe's really does a lot to make sure that they are not only giving back, but that they are invoking a very, in some ways, radical model of learning, where they are ensuring that each student has an opportunity to have additional opportunities outside of just their classroom. And one of the things that is offered through St. Joe's is Ripples of Hope, which is essentially created by the Pittman family. The Pittman family is the family of Eric Pittman, who was a student at St. Joe's. He was a student who was interested in law, who was interested in social justice, who was interested in politics, who spoke highly of his interest in moving forward in the space of different justice initiatives, and really wanted to come into the world and make the world a better place. I can honestly speak for myself. When I was in high school and preparing to transition into high school, I was not having those thoughts at all. So Eric was ahead of his time and ahead of most of our times as well. Eric unfortunately passed away, and his family has kept his legacy alive and has found a beautiful way to give back to St. Joe's and to many other students who are interested in essentially creating innovation in their community and in the world by creating Ripples of Hope, which is a lecture series that they do every single year. It's very short because, kids don't want to be in school. Yeah, it's so high school. But it's very short. But essentially, it is a lecture series. The students essentially get to run it. They get to introduce the speaker. They are involved in getting the reception set up, the little small reception after. They, obviously invite the Pittman family. The family comes. The school students get to come. They get to decide to stay after school and essentially come to this lecture series, and they have it once a year. This year, it was really focused on mental wellness. And so I am so appreciative of Dan Warner and his entire team over at St. Joe's that reached out in short notice and said, we have an opening for this this speech and for this keynote series this year. Would you like to be interested? And so we kind of jumped in and curated something that was really cool. But Ripples of Hope has been happening for a couple of years now. And I am so grateful to the Pittman family for taking a very tragic situation and creating something really beautiful for the students to keep Eric's memory alive.
Obviously, kudos to the Pittman family and working through their grief in that fashion, but also to St. Joe's for doing this. At the same time, though, what kind of reaction did you see from the students?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this year's conversation was called Like, Comment, Subscribe. And what I really wanted to do was identify what is a way to engage students in conversations surrounding mental wellness. One of the things that we are seeing a large trend in is the presence of social media with our students these days, with our high school students. I remember I got my first phone when I was 16 years old. I was not that student. I was not allowed to bring it to school, right? We knew that it was going to be a distraction. Nowadays, kids have their phones all the time. They have them by the time they're 3, 4, 5, 6.
Right.
They can work a tablet probably better than I can.
Yeah.
Social media and YouTube and all those other sites, they play a huge presence in students' behaviors others and how they feel about themselves. And so what we did was we took this topic and we really looked at the intersectionality of social media on imposter syndrome, which imposter syndrome is not an actual diagnosis in the DSM-5 or the, you know, diagnostic statistic manual that all psychologists use and clinical social workers to diagnose. But it is essentially a phenomenon where essentially the brain tells us that in some way, we are not performing up into the level of another person or another entity. And so therefore, we are an imposter. And we are not qualified for being in a given role. That can be related to a lot of factors, which we found were incongruent to what our students were telling us, right? Parental standards, going to a very competitive school district and being in a very competitive school system, just high parental standards, high school standards. But we also found that a large presence for imposter syndrome across the board, both for students and for adults altogether, has been comparison. And what we wanted to talk about in this keynote series was that how it is that students are being affected by social media. Students were really honest. We made it very fun. We made it very interactive. They got to use their phones, so they loved it. gotta reel it in. But they loved it, right? So they're using their phones to identify like what their favorite social media platform is. A large majority of students are using X, otherwise known as Twitter, and YouTube, as well as Instagram, were like the three highest.
Okay.
Snapchat came in at lucky number four. And so they're essentially using these platforms. And one of the things that they acknowledged in using these platforms is that they are usually using these platforms to identify what is going on in other students' lives or in other people's lives. But they oftentimes found that one of the negative and adverse effects of social media was comparison. That was across the board. I don't have all the statistics on it, but it was a room of students. We really wanted to make it interactive. And a lot of students were raising their hands, participating and acknowledging that, unfortunately, one of the adverse effects of social media for them has been comparison to a classmate that might be doing better in a certain subject, comparison to students as it relates to body type and body image, comparison in the classroom as it relates to who it is scoring highest in the classroom or who it is that's scoring lowest in the classroom. Oftentimes, some bullying that's taking place, some harassment that's taking place, right? Some overexposure to, sexual innuendo that's taking place, but a large majority of it was that comparison. And what we found was is that while students didn't have the words to say, oh, yes, you know, I was experiencing imposter syndrome, they were able to acknowledge in that space that that is something that I'm experiencing. It is something that is closely related to what I'm going through right now.
So that's resulting in what, lower self-esteem, other issues?
Yeah, negative self-image is a very big one. So seeing myself as either less than or seeing that I have, that there's something wrong with me, essentially. And then also, of course, that lower self-esteem, not really seeing the worth and value in self because I am consistently comparing to someone else. And it really is kind of in some ways like an inside out moment, if you will, of, you know, my core beliefs have shifted as a result of the large presence of just social media in general.
And Chaney Brockington, I want to finish up with maybe a little bit of a personal question here, but
yeah,
I'm
sure.
It's always, I think, worthwhile to explore this. You know, there's most certainly a very powerful sense of positivity that comes out of you while talking about some things that are very difficult. How do you contend with the reality of some of the things that we're talking about here? That, you know, right here in the city of Buffalo, students that are being suspended, whatever the case may be, violence in the city. How do you kind of stay not above it, but stay engaged and not let it impact you?
Yeah. To be honest, if I'm being completely transparent, it definitely impacts me, right? Even what we've just seen in the past couple of weeks in our political climate.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we don't have time to get into it, but even just the recent deaths that we've seen in the past couple of weeks, that tragic loss of Sonia Massey and so many others that we have lost due to some of the systemic issues that we even talked about today, definitely weighs heavy. And it is very hard at times to, I don't even want to say remain optimistic, but find a sense of optimism to be able to move forward. But I have to acknowledge that I really do love what I do. And I know that I have a lot of different hands in different pots right now, right? I'm doing work in the mental wellness field. I'm still trying to stay involved in social justice. When I was in school and I was graduating from Lemoyne, one of the things that was the slogan, and I believe it was said by like St. Ignatius or someone, but it was go forth and set the world on fire. Mm. And that was something that really stuck with me because it is, I believe it's kind of like a life mantra right now. We are in a current climate, both politically, systemically, socially, where we are all going to need to be change makers in some way, shape, or form. We're all going to have to find a way to go forth and set the world on fire. We're all going to have to find a way to get involved in social justice. And knowing that there are people, like-minded individuals that I get to surround myself with on a daily basis that are interested in seeing change, that are interested in being a part of, you know, a good trouble, as John Lewis said, and you know, just joining that fight and that movement to be able to push forward and do the work that's needed, and to be able to be a part of a speck in that bucket, really just kind of, it keeps me going. I'm also very grateful for the optimism of my mother and my grandmother, who were also change makers and drivers in their own light, and really kind of paved a pathway. And my own grandfather, who grew up in, you know, 1930s Jim Crow Mississippi, who was also a change maker in his own life and continued this path forward and really made a path for not just freedom, but also a path for resilience. And it passed for not just taking no for an answer and continuing to move forward. And so between ancestors, between that strong family lineage, between an amazing education that propelled us to say, what's next? How do we make better change? How do we move things forward? But also recognizing that, like, we all have to be a part of it. And I have a part to play and I have a responsibility and a role. Not doing it to the best of my ability, but continuing to try to move forward. All of that together is, I guess, what keeps me going. And I'm grateful to be able to be a part of it and come to a city and try something new. So it's amazing.
And awesome. I'm so glad that path brought you here to What's Next with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Chaney Brockington, our guest here on What's Next.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.